Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's October 1st. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Currently, we've got 46 degrees here in Old Town Park City, 45 degrees in the Heber Valley, and on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning, Nate.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Wasatch back. We're looking at more of a wash, rinse, and repeat pattern of what we saw in the last couple of days. A little cooler this morning than this time yesterday, but overall, climbing with high pressure in place back to the mid-70s this afternoon with plenty of shine. Overnight lows should fall back into the upper 40s, mid-40s, similar to where we were this morning. 48's expected with 77 again on your Wednesday. A little bit of an increase towards the end of the week. We should get to almost 80 degrees on Friday. High pressure that's in place shifts a little further east over the Four Corner area, so that just allows a little bit more of a southwest flow across the Beehive State, and that tends to draw up warmer air, so we tend to warm up a little bit more than where we are today. So almost 80 on Friday. We're approaching record highs, should drop into the mid-70s over the weekend, but sunshine continues into next week. Should see a little bit of cloud cover at times over the weekend, some moisture rotating around that ridge, but not enough to merit any showers. Temperatures usually in the low 60s this time of year for Park City. So, boy, really, at least they're comfortable temperatures, not too hot. Heber looking at 81, mostly sunshine today, 84 tomorrow. We do climb to about 85 by Friday, and we should stay in those low 80s over the weekend with partly cloudy to mostly sunny skies. Overnight lows dipping into the upper 30s and low 40s, however, for your morning start each day.
Okay, Nate, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. He'll have a preview of this week's County Council meeting. Later on, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. I'll be talking with Peace House Executive Director Kendra Wyckoff and Prevention Coordinator Aaron Metal. They'll have details about their upcoming Be the Light event happening this Saturday. And the Director of Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox, in to discuss some open space issues, including the Drink Beer Save Land upcoming Hoppy Hour. Leadership Park City's Class 30 has designed a new app to help Spanish speakers learn more about local events and resources more easily. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has more on that.
Members of the most recent leadership class and supporters from around town gathered at the Swanner Eco Center Sunday afternoon to celebrate the launch of Colectiva, an app intended to help the Latino community connect with more events and organizations. Class 30 member Chantel Guadarrama, who works for the Summit County Health Department, says she got the idea for the app after noticing community resources weren't as accessible as they could be for Spanish speakers. She says the app can be used to sign up for a class, learn about upcoming events, and connect with local nonprofits. Miriam Nieto of Holy Cross Ministries says she sees the app as a tool to help serve her organization's clients.
Let's picture someone that just arrives into the community, right? And they don't speak the language. They don't know what resources are in the community. So if they download the app, you're going to find the Christian Center, Peace House, Health Department. So all the resources that can support a family just arriving and make it easier for them to navigate the system.
Local nonprofits can sign up online to add their events and information to the app. Resources for organizations to spread the word about Colectiva are available at kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, until now, it's been difficult to drive between Silver Creek Estates and the Bittner Ranch area in the northern Snyderville Basin. As KPCW's Connor Thomas reports, a new connector road will open on Friday.
Silver Creek Estates and Bittner Ranch Road are about a mile apart, but previously, getting from one to the other required motorists to make a 6-mile trip out to Interstate 80 and through Kimball Junction. That trip will get a lot shorter Friday afternoon when Mammoth Drive officially opens to connect the two communities. Summit County Special Projects Engineer Mike Kendall says the new road has been open to westbound traffic for about a month.
So we're excited for that. We still have a little bit of work that's going to be done on the side of the road, outside of the travel lanes. So you might still see some workers if you drive through that area, but we will be having that opened up.
The road connects Bittner Ranch Road to Silver Creek Road via two new roundabouts. Geneva Rock has been the county's contractor. The project includes a paved pedestrian and bicycle trail along the new and old roads. Mammoth Drive has paved shoulders, too. Announced last year, the road is named for Ice Age-era remains found in the field the road will cross, including a mammoth's tooth Alan Lewis found in his backyard in 1963. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Wasatch County Council meets Wednesday at 4 o'clock, and on the phone with a meeting preview is Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, first off, do you have any updates with regard to the Yellow Lake fire?
I know that as of this morning, that the Yellow Lake fire is 0% contained. I think their estimate's around 2,300 acres. We have multiple crews out there, multiple aircraft vehicles responding. I think the rain helped a little bit, but there were still sections of it that are on fire. So they're taking it very seriously.
Yeah, so you do have some county resources going toward that fire, huh?
We do. We have our local file crews as well as our local emergency management. Thankfully, we have some great experience and some great capabilities, and we're just trying to stay on top of it as much as we can.
Yeah. How much does the county budget for fighting wildfires every year?
It's a little bit of a complicated situation in that most entities participate in a state pool for wildfire responses, and it's based on a formula of what a rolling average of fires have been. Actually, the county has done pretty good in recent years, and because of that, we have paid into the state pool, I think, a pretty reasonable amount. I don't know the number off the top of my head. This fire will end up coming into that calculation so that in successive years, we'll probably end up paying a little bit more into it. So it's kind of like a self-insurance program.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about how the budgeting process is going.
Yeah, we had a discussion with the council at our last meeting, and they solidified some of the priorities that they're looking at. Tomorrow, we will be discussing with them the transit portion of the budget. Because we passed a new sales tax that'll go into effect next year, their council is interested in how we prioritize the use of those funds. Ultimately, we'll present the tentative budget in November. So right now we're in the thick of developing the details, doing the financial forecasts. Because we're doing some construction projects right now, we're not expecting to have a whole lot of excess revenue beyond the expected needs, but we aren't asking for any additional tax dollars. We think any revenue that we're coming in from existing revenue sources is going to cover all the needs that the county is going to have for next year.
All right. Yeah, that's the last time we talked that no tax increase will be needed for next year's budget. So how is Wasatch County paying for emergency services? As you may know, Summit County looking to approve a sales tax measure on our November ballot. How are you paying for those services?
Yeah, so our fire district does have a property tax levy, but we passed the EMS sales tax last year at an election. And so that's a significant portion of how the fire district is continuing to operate and planning for the future. They're working on some construction projects right now. There is a new fire station under construction in Heber, and they're working on one in Hideout. And so that sales tax has become really instrumental. I believe it's the same 0.5% that voters approved that is applying here in Wasatch County.
Yeah. And then any sort of taxing issues? Will Wasatch County voters have any sort of taxing issues to address on the ballot then?
I don't believe so. Not this year, no.
Yeah. All right. And as you mentioned, one of the agenda items is that discussion about transit. The council, as you said, has already voted to support that additional transit sales tax. So that's a tax that does not need to be approved by voters?
Correct. There are certain portions of those transit sales taxes that are required to be approved by voters. The one that we adopted is not. So we've talked about utilizing a portion of it for public safety and a portion of it for transit.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that breakdown. So how much for public safety and how much for transit?
Yeah, so we estimate that next year the sales tax will bring in about $3.6 million. We allocated 25% of that for public safety, so that's about $900,000. And the remaining $2.7 million is what we're talking about on Wednesday. We think that will end up breaking down into, I believe the council's highest priority is funding our paratransit service. High Valley Transit has worked with us kind of on a case-by-case basis on paratransit, but we're really excited to be able to launch the full service here in Wasatch County. So that's additional driver hours and making sure that we have the specialized vehicles necessary to have people who have qualified disabilities receive a pre-planned, pre-arranged trip with a higher degree of reliability than our current kind of general service allows. That will only take up about $200,000. The other two items really that we're looking at, maybe three, is improvements to the microtransit service, improvements to the fixed bus route, and then any savings or investment in capital infrastructure. And obviously, portion of that of discussion that we've had is also making sure that we're paying for the current service and making sure that the financial situation of that is sustainable, which we, with this new sales tax, it'll be fully sustainable and be able to do some new things as well.
All right. So that needs to be paid locally for paratransit, huh? There's no state or federal funding available for something like that?
You know, most of the grants that are available for transit, and Caroline Rodriguez, of the executive director of Highline Transit, probably could speak better to it, but generally there are grants for kind of fixed costs, mm-hmm. and that might be acquiring vehicles or helping to pay for facilities or other infrastructure improvements. But most ongoing costs tend to need a revenue source. In both all of Highs Valley Transit service area, we have been using sales taxes as those primary, and that's really, as outlined in state code, those are the primary revenue sources available on transit.
Yeah, and as you may recall, you heard from a resident, Shelley Hokanson, at the September 18th meeting, saying she needs help with driving to get to her dialysis appointments. I mean, this was hard to believe, that this poor woman couldn't get to life-saving treatment. Did anybody reach out to her, or will she be taken care of once this new paratransit goes through?
Yeah, so we did actually reach out to High Valley Transit and worked out with them that, like I said, they're working with us on a case-by-case basis and providing a 24-hour advanced booking service. And so I think that we're able to address this specific situation now. But the ideal scenario is come January, we will have this service available on a much wider basis, and it will be a lot more consistent. And I think it will be really what will help both Shelley's situation and everyone else's who's in a similar situation.
Okay, so she's set to go until at least January 1st.
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Also on the agenda is a discussion of whether to provide a contribution to the Utah Association of Counties for Public Lands Advocacy. This is basically in order to gain local control over federally owned or undesignated lands. So what's your guess? I mean, is this something that the county council supports, returning federal lands to the state?
You know, the council hasn't voted on it. I think initial indications seem like the council is supportive. There was a request from the Utah Association of Counties to see if they wanted to file an amicus brief, which is a legal notice that an entity is wishing to support one argument or another in a separate legal case. And in this situation, UAC is interested in providing a support to the state's effort to turn those federally undesignated lands back over to the state. But rather than force all the counties to contribute, they're kind of letting each county decide whether they want to opt in and support this, because we know that it's not going to be universal. Not everyone's agree with this position. But I do think it's likely that the county, Wasatch County Council, will support it.
Any idea how much federal undesignated land there is in Wasatch County?
You know, there is not a lot in Wasatch County. We have small portions of the BOR that has undesignated lands here. Most of it is national forest, which should not, and no one intends for it to affect those things. So I think generally the council is interested in other areas because it does affect our constituents who recreate in those areas, even if it's not within the county's borders. So I think that's some of the considerations that the council is weighing.
Mm-hmm. And something that kind of struck me as I was thinking about this topic, just in terms of, you know, the state of Utah has been pretty vocal in terms of saying, you know, the state could do a better job of managing the lands. I think the state also sees these lands brought to the state as a way for new, more growth and more development. And like I say, it started getting me to think, does Wasatch County have any kind of checks on growth? I mean, have any studies been made by the county to determine maybe what the carrying capacity is? I mean, when we look at traffic on US 40, we know that it's clogged. What about the rest of the infrastructure? I mean, we've got complaints already from, you know, smells coming from the sewer ponds. I mean, water availability. I mean, do we have the water? I mean, certainly Wasatch County sits between two large reservoirs, but it's not the county's water.
Yeah, so that is a topic that has come up numerous times, because you're right, there are limitations. We live in a high mountain desert, and ultimately there is a limit to how much the carrying capacity of the land is. I think that in the context of some of the projections is largely where those discussions have come up. I believe the Kemsey Gardner Institute has projected the county more than doubling by 2080. But it's possible that sometime before that is when we hit that carrying capacity. Some of the question marks rely around, like you said, water, in that we have a finite amount of water available, but what is more flexible is water practices. And so I think that's where the state has put a lot of emphasis on trying to do some water conservation efforts, and the ability for a home to use water inside and out affects how you utilize that water. So while the water amount is fixed in that the amount of supply for the area, how you use it and how much you use is a little bit up in the air. And I think their concern that the county has is that we wouldn't want to get into a situation where we have no ability to weather drier years. And I think the advantage we have right now is we still have a fair amount of agriculture, and it's much easier to turn off water to a farm and lie fallow for a year than it is to tell a whole subdivision that you can't take a shower or wash your clothes or drink water or things like that.
Yeah, well, when you got a new resort too, it's like about snowmaking, but I guess you consider that wintertime water use as opposed to, you know, taxing the system even more during the summer.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, for many years, the county has been conscious of water needs in those areas, and the resort itself has been paying water reservation fees, so they have a fair chunk of those water rights. But there might be times when the reservoir isn't capable of providing 100% of those water rights, and that's when things like you know, we've seen in other parts of the state where they have to do water conservation efforts or efforts to try and make sure people curb their water consumption. So if it came to it, I think we would like to avoid those circumstances, but we would make those decisions when we came to those events.
All right. Another agenda item is a discussion on what feedback to provide to UDOT for safety improvements along the Northern Highway US 40. The plan is to install center dividers. So do we have a problem here? I mean, are we experiencing head-on crashes already?
Yeah, I mean, if you look, pretty much every summer we have very serious accidents, often fatalities, in this stretch of North Highway 40. I think it's been a priority for UDOT for some time, and we've known that this effort has been on the books for a few years now, just because of that high critical life and safety need. There is some concern around how it affects the access for people who currently live along this corridor. It's part of what we're going to discuss. I think we also want to make sure that any major civic needs are addressed. The current breaks in the proposed center median align with where the future intersections may be, with one exception of there on Potter's Lane and University Avenue. I don't believe is intended to have an intersection, but will have a break. There are some other things that we're looking at, making sure that we have access for future fire stations and other things like that, to be able to make sure that everyone can safely get across the freeway where it makes sense. But we also don't want to jeopardize the life and safety of people traveling on this well-used highway.
Okay, and that's what I was going to ask. Is this going to make these dividers, does it make left turns even more difficult? And that's when you really, now instead of head-ons, we've got, you know, T-bones accidents.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will make left turns in many places impossible, because you won't be able to cross over to that far travel lane. I think in a lot of circumstances, that is a significant safety improvement, because when the road is very busy, it can be tempting to try and take a left turn, but it maybe isn't the safest alternative. And what this would do is force people to right turns and then take U-turns, which is admittedly inconvenient, but it's just kind of the policy question of how do you weigh the convenience against those health and safety concerns.
All right. And as we've reported, the Heber Valley Special Service District has withdrawn its application to become an industrial protection area. Would this have eventually come to the County Council for final approval, or was the final approval with Midway City?
So the HVSSD was applying as an entity for a similar level of protection that we have already granted on our many other agricultural properties, predominantly in the Northfields areas. So it's an identical level of protection. The council does authorize it because it's under the county code. What it would do is just allow, just like those farms, allow a property owner to be able to continue to use the property in its current state, and not be sued for using it in the ways in which it's currently being used, but not It doesn't prevent someone or grant them any additional rights. In the same way that a farmer couldn't develop their land under this, the HVSSD farm wouldn't have been granted additional, you know, land use rights or additional protections for things like negligence or if there were other critical issues that needed to be addressed. This doesn't protect it. It more protects it of if they're doing the normal things they do, whether that's a farmer, you know, collecting hay and maybe that hay causes dust, it protects them from that lawsuit in the same way that HVSSD doing their normal operations, if there's no, you know, other issues that are concerning and need to be addressed, that it protects them from those things, that really allows them to focus on what their mission and making the improvements that I think they're very genuinely committed to making.
So why was it withdrawn? They feel like they can fix any issues?
I think it was just out of an abundance of caution and making sure that the public felt like they were aware of it. They have had a public meeting, I believe a few of them leading up to them actually submitting the application. And I think there was not a lot of tension then. We did have multiple public meetings scheduled for this. So the normal process is that goes to the Planning Commission, as well as our Soil Conservation Board, which acts as a body to make recommendations along those, and then to the County Council. So I think everyone wants to just make sure that the public is aware of what this proposal would do and that their voices are heard.
Yeah, I mean, you had said that you were hoping that this area, this new area, would shield the county and special service district from what you call frivolous lawsuits. But I guess if somebody is getting sick from the stench, that doesn't seem very frivolous.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's not something that this protection area would do, is that if there were legitimate health and safety concerns being caused by the sewer district, the agricultural and industrial protection area doesn't offer any protections on those lines. What it would do, though, is protect them from unproven claims of those concerns. Just because it smells does not mean that it's necessarily causing those health concerns. And I believe the state and the county health department are both looking into those issues to make sure that everyone is healthy and safe. I think all of us are very interested in making sure that we're addressing it. And again, it's not the intention of the HVSSD, or at least my understanding of the county council's perspective, to not address those concerns about smell and use and to continue to make improvements. But I think by avoiding lawsuits that would be those nuisance lawsuits, it actually frees them up to be able to address those operational issues that might be contributing to those public perception issues, and not have to end up spending a lot of time battling what otherwise might be unnecessary legal challenges.
Yeah, but if something doesn't get fixed, I mean, it's only going to get worse as more people move in and then housing gets built even closer to it, no?
You know, I think there is a limit, just like we talked about carrying capacity for water, there's a limit to what that sewer pond can and cover. I think ultimately, if the county continues to grow in the rate at which it does, there will need to be additional sewer facilities. Those will likely be more modern mechanical plants that will service some of those newer developments. I know Heber City is looking into some aggressive annexations that I doubt that the sewer ponds will ultimately be able to service from both just a logistics standpoint and a capacity as well.
Okay. I got to leave it there. Dustin, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. The Yellow Lake Fire, which sparked Saturday afternoon in eastern Wasatch County, has grown to 2,300 acres, and it remains 0% contained. U.S. Forest Service spokesperson Sierra Hellstrom says the fire received a light amount of rainfall Sunday night, but continues to burn in heavy timber. Hellstrom says the difficult terrain is complicating fire efforts.
One of the things that we're seeing in this area is a lot of dead and downed wood. There's a lot of bark beetle kill in this area. So it's highly susceptible to snags and tree falls. So it's not an area where we can insert crews safely.
She says as a result, crews are using an indirect attack where firefighters will go in advance of the fire line and find natural barriers where they can create fuel breaks. Hellstrom says 80 personnel have arrived on site since Saturday, and air support is being used to slow the fire's progress. The fire is burning in the area east and south of Mill Hollow Reservoir and has come close to a YMCA campground, but she believes fire crews will be able to protect that area. Closures in the area include Mill Hollow on the west side, the Soapstone Basin area south of Highway 50, Iron Mine Mountain to the east, and the West Fork of the Deschene River in the south. Hailstorm reminds drivers that Highway 35 remains closed at mile marker 12 in both directions. She expects the road to remain closed for the next few days as crews work to remove fallen timber on the roadway. The cause of the fire is still under investigation. Well, October is Domestic Violence Month, and the Peace House has an upcoming event to celebrate survivors and to create change in our community. In the studio with details, I have Peace House Executive Director Kendra Rykoff along with Outreach Manager Erin Mettel. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Kendra, let's just start with you. Maybe you can provide us with some of the domestic violence statistics you see here in Summit and Wasatch counties.
Well, let me just speak to the statewide issues that we're seeing. So one in three women and one in five men will experience domestic violence in their lifetime. And that is a result of a survey from the Centers for Disease Control. Here in our own communities, we likely are seeing probably similar rates. We know that domestic violence often goes unreported. So it's very difficult sometimes to pinpoint exactly what is happening behind the closed doors in our homes. But what we do know is that, you know, in Park City, generally the police department sees anywhere between about 80 and 100 cases a year of domestic violence or family fights. Summit County, historically, we've seen their numbers around 200 cases. And then at Peace House, we're serving on average now about 500 people year to year. And those are just the folks that are reaching out for help, right, through the criminal justice system or support with law enforcement and with Peace House as a community-based advocacy program.
So Domestic Violence Month was designed what, just to shed light?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was in the late 80s. It was really an opportunity to say this is an issue in our country. It's an epidemic. Often gender-based violence, so often women and girls are experiencing domestic violence and family violence, but we also know that men are victims of domestic violence. And the whole purpose was really to raise awareness and to encourage people to get involved in issues that are revolving around family violence. So learning what resources are available, learning what the red signs are, learning how to appropriately respond to somebody who may disclose to you about violence, and knowing as communities that we actually can be individuals that help people out who are in these situations. You don't have to be an expert. You can simply be somebody who listens, who offers hope, knows what resources are available, and believes survivors.
Something that was news to me when I opened up your website to prepare for the interview was that homicide is the leading cause of death for pregnant women in the U.S.?
Yes, it is. And I know that's a really surprising statistic, but it is the leading cause of death. And we know that when women become pregnant, we see increases in domestic violence. And so it's such an important issue for medical providers to be aware of, to be screening for domestic violence. We know that our own Intermountain Healthcare providers here in the community do that. It's such a critical issue. And we can't exactly say why that happens, but we know that domestic violence is about power and control. And when somebody wants to have power and control, and they see that another person might be either moving away from that relationship or focusing their attention on something else, we often see an escalation in violence and abuse.
Hmm. Erin, so as outreach manager, you've got something planned for Saturday. Tell us about that.
Yes, so we are hosting our annual Be the Light event. This year it will be held in Heber at Main Street Park. And this event kind of combines education and fun for Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So we plan to have a walk around the park in Heber. We have an excellent lineup of speakers. The mayor of Heber, Heidi Franco, is one of our speakers, as well as Celine Olson, who is a local of Park City. And she will be telling her story as a survivor, but also her resiliency and her efforts in creating change in our community. So we have a great lineup of live music. We have Lumberjack Fabulous, who is a local band, performing. And then we also have food trucks that are available. And then we'll have some community partners out there sharing the resources. Events like this are great to gain more information about what resources are available in the community. So local organizations like Holy Cross Ministries, Live Like Sam, will be there as well to share their resources with the community.
Okay, so it's at the Heber City Main Street Park. When is it happening?
It is from 3 to 5 p.m.
All right. Do people need to register?
We prefer if they do register on our website, which is peacehouse.org.
All right. And then food trucks. So food will be available for purchase then? Is that how it's going to work?
Yeah. So adults can purchase food, and they are providing free food for children with the purchase of an adult meal.
All right. And you're looking for volunteers.
We are, yes. We love our volunteers. They provide so much support and help for us. So we have a couple different ways people can volunteer. They can show up early and help with setup. They can attend the event and volunteer during the event, or they can help us with cleanup afterwards.
Okay. And again, that's information's on the website?
Yes, that information's on the website. They can also reach out and call our phone number and get connected with our volunteer coordinator, Madison, to get more information about volunteering.
All right. Do you have anything else planned for Summit County?
We do. So we actually yesterday just put up a display at the Park City Police Station. So we have a great connection with Kara Madsen, the victim advocate, and she helped us put a display of flags with a sign explaining what Domestic Violence Awareness Month is. And then we are also collaborating with them to do a display of candles in different buildings throughout Park City. So that could include the city building, the library, to make sure that people know that these are safe spaces for survivors and that the community is gathering behind them and supporting them.
All right. It also looks like you've got a volunteer training coming up next week, October 8th. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, absolutely.
What's that for?
So at Peace House, we try to have a volunteer training at least twice a year. And the purpose of that is for individuals who are interested in doing direct service. Our requirements at Peace House, in order to provide those direct services to individuals who are affected by these issues, it requires that you have 40 hours of training so that you can be certified as a confidential advocate, both as a domestic violence advocate and a sexual assault advocate. So if you're interested in the hospital response team or working even at the front desk or providing support in other ways, like working in the emergency shelter, this is the way to start that process, to be able to get that foundational training so that you feel well equipped to be able to support the needs of survivors who are reaching out for help.
All right. And then you've also got something, it sounds like it's for the Spanish-speaking community, October 24th, Puente Comunitario, what's that?
Yes, so Puente Comunitario, Jen Heredia, who is our outreach, bilingual outreach advocate, she has been having monthly community gatherings at the Peace House campus with different subjects. So just last week, they talked about suicide prevention, and it really is an open group to reach out to the Latino community here and to just encourage them to get connected to resources, talk about different subjects that might impact their families, be able to provide resources. So we've done some subjects such as mental health. And I'm not sure what this month's subject is, so I apologize for that. But people can go to the website and reach out to Jen directly and find out.
All right. And then you're also got an open house scheduled. October 26th.
Yeah, we're really excited to reach out and celebrate with the community. We actually will be in our facility for 5 years, which feels unbelievable, but we want the community to know that Peace House is a safe place to reach out for resources that, you know, we are publicly disclosed for a reason. That's to increase awareness and accessibility. So we're going to have an open house on Saturday, October 26th from 9:30 to 11:30 in the morning. That way people can come over, have some breakfast with us, have the opportunity to do a tour on our first floor, hear more about programs and services, and understand what resources are available. And then lastly, we're going to have a little contest, social media contest. We'll be giving folks pumpkins to take home to decorate and make peaceful pumpkins, and we'll be able to share a fun little prize with the grand prize winner of that contest.
All right. Well, you mentioned you see about 500 folks a year. What are some of the services that you provide them in addition to just a safe place to be?
Right. So we have our housing program, which is the emergency shelter and transitional housing. And that's probably the most familiar program for folks is the shelter, because that was the cornerstone of what we were built upon. And that's that safe place where people can go when they're immediately fleeing and they're in crisis. Transitional housing is a housing program that provides that wraparound support and housing for up to 2 years, where individuals have the opportunity to work on rebuilding their lives while they're connected to all those comprehensive services that happen on our campus. And some of those services are things like legal advocacy, so help with protective orders or stalking injunctions, or getting connected to an attorney that might be able to help with custody or divorce. It includes case management, who's really, a case manager is really that advocate that walks alongside a victim of domestic violence in their family to ensure that they are assessing safety and they are addressing addressing that, but also looking at all the myriad of needs that survivors have, everything from housing to employment to childcare to medical care to mental health wellness. We have clinical counselors on our campus that provide support to adult survivors and their children. These are mastered level clinicians that are able to provide trauma-based therapies that are modalities that assist victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And then we have our sexual assault program that responds out to the hospital to provide support to individuals who may be presenting there after an assault and they need a forensic exam. Wasatch Forensic Nurses does the forensic exam, but Peace House is there to provide the advocacy support and then get them linked to all of the other programs. And then lastly, you know, as we talk about all those intervention services, it's so important for people to know that we have this incredible prevention program, which Aaron is part of, where we see over 20,000 people a year, youth and family members, that we're touching their lives through a number of different ways, whether that be in the schools or out in the community, tabling and connecting with folks. But that is incredibly impactful because our goal is really to prevent violence before it even begins so that we can get upstream and on these rates and reduce the rates in our state and our community.
So when you get out into the schools, Aaron, I mean, how is that, I guess, presented to young kids?
Yeah, absolutely. We really make sure all of our content is age appropriate. We want to make sure that these topics are meeting the kids where they're at. And so we really focus on empowering the kids and making sure they know that they can use their voice if someone's making them feel unsafe or uncomfortable. And then as they get older into middle school and high school, we really want to demonstrate what a healthy relationship looks like. We notice that teenagers tend to model behaviors after what they see, and maybe they're modeling some unhealthy behaviors or they just don't know what a healthy relationship actually looks like. So we want to make sure that we're getting in there, and before they have these relationships, we lay that foundation for them of a healthy and safe relationship, and also teach all kids that they deserve to feel safe at home, at school, and out in their community.
Oh, so how many classrooms do you get into?
We give about 315 presentations per calendar year.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're very busy.
Yeah, starting in what grade?
Kindergarten, as young as kindergarten.
Oh, okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I think we just want to make sure that our community knows we're here for them 24/7. The lights are always on at Peace House, so you can reach out a number of different ways, but our helpline is probably one of the most efficient ways. So if you call 1-800-647-9161, there are always trained advocates available to help you or someone that you know.
All right. Kendra Wyckoff, Aaron Metal, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.
In the studio from Summit Land Conservancy, I have CEO Cheryl Fox. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning.
Let's start with the news that 4,200 acres of land has been protected in Echo Canyon.
That's right. So this is property that we've been working to save. We began talking to this family, well, probably before 2017, but we've been working on this project since 2017. It's big at 4,200 acres. As you drive from Park City up to Evanston, it's on both sides of the highway, and of course way back in on both sides, kind of where the red rocks are. This family has been incredibly patient. We made 5 applications to the federal government before it was funded. So 5 years of putting in the application, and you know, sometimes it would rank the highest of any of the applications our friends at the Natural Resources Conservation Service would receive, but because it was so big, it was so expensive. So we worked with the landowners, and they were patient with us, and anyway, finally we did get it funded, and that was announced about a year ago, well, a year and a half ago, and then, of course, we just went full steam ahead to the closing. So the exciting thing also about this family is that this is the second conservation easement that they've done with us. They also preserved a little over 800 acres in Chalk Creek, up in Chalk Creek. And again, if you drive up Chalk Creek, you'll sort of drive by it, but most of the property that was preserved is higher up that's not super visible from the road. But so all told, this family has protected about 5,000 acres.
Yeah, so why is this, I mean, freeway, you know, land near a freeway, why is that worth protecting?
Because the freeway goes through a part of it, but, you know, there's a huge amount of land away from the freeway as well. It is habitat for elk and mule deer and other a lot of other wildlife, of course. It's also the watershed. All of this is watershed for the Great Salt Lake. And, you know, sometimes we think of watershed and we think, well, is it sopping wet? Is it a pond? Is it a spring? Of course, there are springs on this property. How those springs eventually get to the creek, to the Weber River matters. If we go into a place like this, again, close to I-80, easy to, you know, have an off-ramp, easy to drive in there, easy to get it developed, or it would be. At least it's close to, you know, those types of infrastructure needs. So we feel like if you do that, then, you know, you cut up the hydrology and you put in pipes and you make all kinds of damages. So,
yeah. So what kind of local contribution will it take then to kind of close that?
So the easement is finished. Mm. It has been preserved. Summit County put in a total of $860,000 to help. A portion of that came from the Summit County bond, the $50 million bond, and a portion of it also came from the Eastern Summit County Agricultural Preservation Society, which is funded through developer lot sales at Promontory. So every time a new lot is purchased at Promontory, they put a little money aside into this fund, which we really appreciate. All of these funds are managed by committees, and then ultimately the county council makes the decision. So, and that was leveraged many times over by a large grant from the NRCS.
And you're also looking at putting in applications for some adjacent properties then to this Echo Canyon land.
Exactly. So on Friday, the federal applications are due again, and we're putting in four applications, and each one of those is for about 4,000 acre properties. One of them is adjacent to this property and then adjacent to that property. So it's a huge swath if we're able to get this funded all around Echo Reservoir and Colville and the sort of the junction of 80 and 84.
All different landowners?
Four different landowners. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what kind of funding do you need for that?
Each one is a little bit different, but, you know, it's pretty extensive, and we're hoping that the Inflation Reduction Act, which is funneling more money into the Farm Bill programs that we've been using all along, will be there to step up at this moment, right? We have, again, so many landowners who want to save their land, and I want to tell you that, you know, these landowners do get paid, and they do get to keep their land, but they don't get paid full value. They make an incredible donation every time. And that's equity that they've built up in their property over generations sometimes. And they just walk away from that because they want to see it protected also.
Yeah, so when they get the tax benefit, is that like a one-year deal, or can that be amortized, I guess, over?
It can be amortized or rolled over, mm-hmm. over up to 15 years. So there's a really attractive tax benefit for people who donate a conservation easement on property or donate a portion of a conservation easement, which is what's happening in these situations. The reason for that is the IRS recognized, Congress recognized, that when people donate a conservation easement on property, it's an incredible value. It's usually a lot of money that they're giving up. And most farmers and ranchers don't have a lot of income to offset that kind of a gift. So the federal government realized that in order to be fair, they needed to have a longer horizon for people to be able to try to recoup some of that that gift. In these cases, the gift is so, I mean, it's millions of dollars. It's unlikely that these people will be able to recoup it.
All right. You're also hiring. Who are you looking for?
We are looking for a stewardship specialist. We're excited about this because we have increased our easements, the amount of land we protect and the number of easements that we protect so much in the past 4 or 5 years. We need another full-time person. This is a full-time position. They spend a lot of time in the field. They also spend a lot of time in the office wrangling all the information that they have into reports. So information is available on the Summit Land Conservancy's website at wesaveland.org and click on the Teams tab.
All right. And team. What kind of background would this person have?
In general, science, probably rangeland biology, ranching, that type of background, because you're out a lot and you know, you need to know one type of plant from another. Also, you know, it is in the field quite a bit, so somebody who's willing to kind of be out and about. Also, GIS and real good computer skills, because putting these things back into the reports that we have to keep is also really important.
Yeah. And that means now you've got to raise their salary and benefits, yeah.
That's right. We always do. Yes.
Okay. An event always fun to look forward to. This will be the 10th annual, I think, your Hoppy Hour. Tell us how this works.
That's right. We are so excited to be again partnering with Top of Maine, formerly the Wasatch Brew Pub, on our clothing optional, locally produced wild hops ale. You know, we went and harvested at the end of September, end of August, sorry. And Niels Imboden from the brewery up there puts the hops right into the vat that day. And they brew and stew for a few weeks, and then he produces this beer. So we're very excited about it. This is the 10th anniversary. I can't believe it's already been 10 years that we've been doing Hoppy Hour. So it's on October 10th. 10-10 and our 10th anniversary. People can go onto our website, wesaveland.org, click on the happenings tab and buy tickets in advance. We really do recommend that because it's a popular event and it does it may sell out. Tickets are also a little less expensive if you buy them in advance. You can get them at the door, and that's always possible. The Top of Maine usually puts on a very nice sort of heavy appetizers. You get to taste the Wild Hops Ale. We have some raffles and celebrate the taste of open space.
And it starts, what, 6 o'clock?
Or? I think so, yeah. Okay. It's called, we like to say drink beer, save land.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the beer, you've tasted it all 10 years.
Yes.
Is it similar every year because it's the same hops that are used?
It's always a little bit different. And I think the thing that I like to say about it is it tastes to me very fresh. I'm not a fan of IPAs. They hurt my tongue. but this, again, it's a wild hops ale. So it tastes more green. It tastes, citrusy, maybe fruity. Fruity's not the right word. I don't know the official terms for what beer is meant to taste like. But it's usually really, it's really delicious. And it feels good to, you know that you're drinking something, again, that was so locally produced. Not only, you know, the hops grew here. And every year it is different, as Niels will say, you know, has said. He doesn't know what he's getting. Some years, you know, the rain comes early, the rain comes late. The very first year that we tried to do this, we waited too late to do the harvest. So it froze, and the hops froze and could not be used. So they still brewed a beer, but it didn't have any of the wild. I don't even know if they brewed the beer. They still threw a party for us, which was very generous of them. And we called it the No Hops Party. But we learned to harvest earlier in the season. So yeah, I would say it will be available also on tap, even if you can't come to Hoppy Hour. And actually, I think they're putting it in cans this year also. You probably have to get those at the Wasatch or at the Top of Maine Brew Pub. So, you know, you can still have a chance to taste it even if you're not able to come to the event.
Okay, so that makes enough beer then for a party and more.
It makes a big vat, yes.
Okay.
We do our, you know, as they used to say, right? We drink our share and sell the rest.
Okay, Cheryl, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
That's Cheryl Fox, CEO of Summit Land Conservancy.